Come on aboard, I promise you. Lots of room for you on the bandwagon.
Welcome into another episode of the Bandwagon Sports Podcast. I'm Brian Moline.
I'm Lisa Braltz.
John Steinbacher.
Glad to be back with you after a couple of weeks.
It's always a couple of weeks.
Yeah. It is always a couple of weeks.
Except when it's not. But
it usually
recently
is.
It has been a couple of weeks break. So here we are again. So before we get started, I actually want to talk about something that we didn't really plan to talk about, but I want to talk about because in the last week I was hanging out with my daughter, and she does that thing in the summer that teenagers will often do where rather than do the thing, they just watch something about it. So for me, it's actually funny that we were talking about Duran Duran earlier because I used to spend my summers watching MTV waiting for Duran Duran videos rather than like going out and doing something fun like playing beach volleyball or whatever. Anyway, so she was like, hey, Mom, if you have like 10 or 15 minutes, I want you to see. Remember when we were watching some of the CrossFit games last year, they did a documentary about the CrossFit games. And for people out there who don't know, CrossFit is like extreme strength and endurance related events. I'm not even sure you would call them sports because they're events. They're things that you do. You ride the spinning cycle and you lift kettlebells and carry them around and you sling sandbags up
extreme
on walls.
Fitness,
extreme fitness. Yeah. Okay. So right. Extreme fitness events. Thank you. And so the CrossFit games, when we were watching some of them last year, we'll talk more about this with Brian in a second. I had a hard time watching them because it was just like they were in California. They were being done on artificial turf and it was like 100 degrees. So on the turf, that means it's a lot harder. But this documentary I thought was really interesting. It's called Fittest on Earth and we'll have a trailer in the show notes later. One thing, so I'm watching this documentary. It's actually really kind of interesting, especially because these people were not in full-on training for the event mode. This was more just like digesting what had happened mode. So they weren't like super intense. They were kind of funny and relaxed. And there were a couple of things I noticed. First of all, in CrossFit, there's so much Icelandic representation in both men and women. Lots of names ending in son and daughter, you know. And lots of, like, really blonde, very red-faced people, like, doing these amazing things in the heat. So there was that. What also struck me is that with these events, a lot of times the athletes have no idea what is going to be thrown at them until they are told, okay, so later on today you're going to be climbing up a pegboard with pegs in your hands, or you have to do 20 push-ups from a handstand without tipping over or having your legs go over a certain point or whatever. So a lot of times they don't know. They're super fit, but they don't know what it is they're going to be doing. And then I also noticed, like, physically they show a lot of signs of physical stress. The thing that stuck out to me the most is the scabs that I would see on people's collarbones from, like, resting the weightlifting bar there. Like, when they – I don't know what that's called when it's like a jerk.
Clean and jerk.
Clean and jerk, whatever. Lily, my daughter, would know. But the men and the women both had these like serious scabs. Their hands get ripped up. It was pretty amazing. And they talk a lot about how they're pushed to the limits of their endurance. I didn't watch the entire documentary, but we ended up watching like 45 minutes of it. So I just wanted to mention that this year's CrossFit Games, the 2016 Games, are starting. Today is July 19th. They're starting today. And there's like teenagers and I can't remember what they call the old people are the masters.
Masters, yes.
Right. So Lily's like, I said, so who are the masters? And she's like, well, and I said, you mean old people like me? And she said, yes. So, but anyway, CrossFit, I think it's fascinating. I would never participate. I'm not really interested in that kind of thing. There's CrossFit gyms. It's kind of a lifestyle that includes food for a lot of people and certain types of exercise. And then there's these people who take it to the nth degree and become athletes and participate in these contests. They get sponsorships, the whole deal.
Yeah, I took a class for a few years in a gym that's now closed. But I took a class for a few years that had some elements of CrossFit. It was not an official CrossFit class.
Don't they call them a box? Their gyms are the box or something.
I
don't know. There's all this lingo.
but it had elements of CrossFit in it. The instructor had taken some CrossFit, but it, like a lot of things, it's a licensing thing, so it wasn't an official CrossFit class because they couldn't use the name, et cetera, et cetera. But there were some elements of it in there, and I will say, doing those types of exercises gives you a really good workout. I never got crazy into it. Like, you know, there were people that took the class like 4 days a week and were doing all this other crazy stuff. I usually did the class 1 to 2 times a week. That was plenty for me. I consider myself a fairly fit person. I'm certainly not to that level by any stretch, nor will I ever be to that level by any stretch. But I never quite got as into it as some other people did. You know, I could appreciate it. And you know, I've actually watched a little bit of the CrossFit games on TV, and I see those people doing all that stuff with giant tires and all that stuff. And I never had the giant tires in my class, by the way. I was a little jealous.
What about
of that.
The super heavy chains? Did you get to flip those super
the ropes?
Heavy chains? Yeah, or whatever they are.
A little, to a very limited degree, we had the ropes, but we didn't have a lot of the big equipment.
So what I thought was weird too about these events is like, they're told like you're going to have to flip this giant concrete block over like 15 times to get to point B. Mm-hmm. And since they don't know, so a lot of it is like physics and figuring out, like this one guy who looked like he could have just like picked it up and carried it, you know, had the hardest time flipping this concrete block because he didn't understand, he couldn't figure out the physics of how to do it successfully. And you're so busy trying to just move it that you're not really looking necessarily at other people. You have a vague idea that somebody's moving far ahead, but you can't sit there and be like, I wonder how they're flipping this block or climbing this thing or whatever. I just thought it was really interesting, too, that somebody who looked like they would be really successful at it really had no idea what they were doing. John, do you have anything to add?
I've CrossFitted.
You have?
Yeah.
Talk about it.
Yeah, there were big tires
really?
To flip. I didn't do it very much. The thing about it that you know was interesting is I think that everyone who CrossFits, when they do it, like you don't know what's happening ahead of time, right? So it's not just at the events. Like you have like Captain CrossFitter, and then they're like, you're gonna do these 17 things. So it was kind of miserable. It was hot. I haven't watched the games. That's why I haven't chimed in very much because I don't know how that happens. So I apologize for my silence. But
that's all right. I've sprung this on you guys. Yeah. So,
it was kind of fun. Afterwards, you feel like miserable.
You definitely feel like you've gotten a workout. That's for sure. It's pretty
intense
stuff.
It's a different
kind
of thing. But
yeah, I don't know. Anyway, I just wanted to bring that up because there's the CrossFit games and then there's the real games. John Williams, everybody, Star Wars, Harry Potter, Indiana Jones, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I think all the movies, he also wrote the Olympic theme.
Yeah.
That was actually something that I learned that I did not really know. I probably knew it, but I had forgotten. So today, you all learned that.
See, that's when you first really knew that NBC is not messing around anymore. All right?
Right.
We're getting John Williams to write the Olympic theme.
That's right.
We mean business.
That's right.
And he basically stole a lot of it like he does, right?
Borrowed.
He borrows from himself quite heavily also.
Yeah.
Let's just say. He's been at it for a while.
Right. Yeah, let's just say
God bless him.
Let's just say that Gustav Holst and his estate should have received some royalties for much of the music in Star Wars. But that's okay. That's okay. I think there's a lot of that, especially in film music.
Sure.
Anyway, all right, moving on from the music, let's talk about the Olympics. So we have a few things planned for listeners regarding the Olympics.
Bandwagon Olympic Spectacular.
That's right. There's been a lot in the news about the Olympics in terms of the Zika virus and what's it really going to be like down there in Rio.
Poop in the water.
Something that I'll get into a little tiny bit more, but in a little bit, but the Russian doping and how the World Doping Agency or whatever they're called is saying like they shouldn't even be there. Mm-hmm. Not only the athletes, but anybody representing Russia, but they shouldn't even be allowed to come. But well, these Olympics are not without controversy. Let's talk about it. We also have specific sports that we want to talk about, but does anybody have any feelings in general about the Olympics right now? Do we want to start with just any vibes?
Well, I think that it seems like now recently the tradition of the Olympics is for a year and a half or so before the Olympics to talk about what a quagmire it is, what a disaster it's going to be.
A poop quagmire.
Yeah. I mean, this happened in Athens. It happened in Russia.
I don't remember it as much in London, do you?
Yeah, I guess London, not as much, but that's true. But a lot of these Olympics now is like, it's going to be a disaster, and they set the bar so low that, you know, we'll have to see what happens. But my guess is everyone's going to be like so delighted that it went off without a hitch. Everything is great. And then we're all going to forget about it. And, you know, probably Rio is going to be, World Cup was there a couple of years ago. And now there's all these empty shells of stadiums. The same thing's going to happen.
It was last year.
Poop is still going to be in the water.
2 years ago. You're right. Yeah,
they still won't have a real president.
Yeah. I mean, it's still going to be in shambles, right. You know, the world's going to move on as we do. That's my prediction.
Well, I think you're right. And it's funny how, like, during the Olympics, it's all going to be like, this is amazing, and it's wonderful in Rio, and you're going to see a bunch of babes on the beach playing hacky sack and all that other stuff. And then afterward, there's going to be this total come down where, you know, there's going to be hard-hitting news segments about how nothing much has changed. I mean, it happens every time. I agree with you.
All right. So we'll see how that goes. Shall we talk about some of our favorite things regarding the Olympics here?
I think we should start this segment with Lisa because it's sort of, she's already established her sport, I think.
Right. Well, so I love ping pong and have since I was a little kid, but not in the way that, like, I obsessively watch ping pong. Really, the Olympics are the only time where it might actually be on television to watch. So I'm really looking forward to ping pong or table tennis. I will say I don't know a whole lot about the field except that it is pretty much dominated by Chinese players. So even though the guy that won the world championship of table tennis, which we talked about in a previous episode, was, I believe, English, I think this is a whole different ball game, so to speak. So I would look for the Chinese to continue to dominate both on the men's and women's side. However, one John Steinbacher just alerted me this morning to an article in the New York Times a few days ago about a 16-year-old American table tennis player, he's going to kind of rock it, they're predicting. 16. He's playing for the United States, but he trains in Sweden, and he's going to Rio to try to beat the Chinese. That's really what's happening here. So there's a great spectator's guide on the Olympics website about table tennis. It's actually designed more for people who will actually be attending the matches, but it gives you an overview of the rules and how it works. And the competitions start on Saturday, August 6th, so I am really looking forward to that. It's pretty intense, and it's actually hard to watch, especially if you're like me and you watch a fair amount of tennis, like actual tennis on the ground, whatever. Table tennis is also a type of tennis. But it just seems so fast and small, and you don't have that overview, really, of the court all the time. So really, you're just sort of seeing these players move really quickly in this very small and close space, and it's super intense. That's why I love it. Somebody at that level could serve it to me and I wouldn't have even known they had done it. It would be because they move so quickly. I mean, so I'm much more of a spectator now than a player, but I'm still really interested. That's my sport. So Saturday, August 6th, that's when it starts.
What do you got, John Steinbacher?
Well, I have gymnastics, but not the big gymnastics that everybody loves. And by the way, if you don't know who, I think it's Simone, and I don't know how to pronounce it, Biles. I'm terrible. If you don't know who she is, and obviously I don't because I don't even know how to pronounce her name, she's going to be the breakout star of the U.S. Olympics. She's the top gymnast in the world. And supposedly, we'll have to see what happens, but supposedly she doesn't really have any real competition. But I say that as someone who is not an expert in gymnastics until a few weeks from now when we all watch gymnastics, and it's awesome because it's fun to watch.
Oh, it's so fun.
But I actually am talking about trampoline gymnastics, which is not quite as... doesn't have all the glory of regular gymnastics or the high ratings, I'm sure it won't. But it's pretty fun to watch. I don't know if either of you have ever watched it, but basically it's people on trampolines doing lots of awesome flips. So it's sort of like, diving. They do all those crazy tucks and spins and twists and things like that. But instead of splashing into water, they have to land on a trampoline, jump back up, and do the same thing over and over again. It's interesting because they have to get jumping first.
Yes.
So you get to watch, like, the first 30 seconds is just them, like, boom, boom,
gaining
boom,
some momentum.
And then they start doing stuff.
So I have a question about the agony of defeat.
Yeah.
So you guys remember on the Wide World of Sports, when
yeah,
they showed the agony of defeat, they showed the skier,
yeah.
like, sort of smashing into everything. So, are there accidents in trampoline? Have you, like, watched any of this? And so, because I am familiar with a lot of
right.
the sweet moves, but I
don't
never...
think it happens as much as you'd think it would.
Right. Like, if I, for yeah. example, or you were to
right,
get on
right,
trampoline.
Right, right, right. I think they're at this point they're pretty good. I mean, in all Olympic sports, people get injured, but
But no one's like
yeah.
just rocketing off the trampoline.
Yeah, and I think they kind of know how to land so as not to break their neck. Obviously, accidents happen, but it happens in regular gymnastics too. The thing about this particular sport is, with overall gymnastics, you have to know how to do lots of different things. This is very specialized, so I don't think there's quite as many. Accidents. This sport also won, dominated by the Chinese. They've won a third of all the medals. It's been a sport in the Olympics since 2000.
Yeah, cool.
There's a couple. The Americans, I won't really go into, but I know that they're both of them were unexpected. The woman who was going to win probably like broke her foot the day before the finals. So. Nicole Ossinger is now the U.S. representative, and there's Logan Dooley. I do know that the guy to look out for is the repeat champion. He's trying to repeat. He's Chinese. His name is Dong Dong.
Dong Dong.
Dong Dong.
All right.
So look out for him. He may be the greatest so far trampoline gymnast of all time.
You did really well there, John.
Thank you.
My event is in the track and field vein, but it's not one of the glory events like the 100 meters, 200 meters. Even the marathon, you know, gets a fair bit of glory. But my event is a great one if you like chaos. The 3,000-meter steeplechase, which if you're not familiar with the steeplechase, it is... Well, it's 3,000 meters, but you have all these obstacles thrown in for good measure. Hurdles, including a big hurdle that you have to, like, jump on top of and leap off of over a water pit.
So it's kind of like CrossFit in a way, where you have,
kind
like...
Kind of, but you know what the obstacles are.
Right, that's
true. They're the same
true.
Every time.
But still, it's a little more exciting that way. So anyway, continue.
Yeah, and it's one of those events where... it's really a specialist kind of thing. You do occasionally have people competing in it who are also highly ranked in, like, the 5,000 meters or something like that. But for the most part, steeplechase athletes are steeplechase athletes. That's what they do. Mm. It is an event that has been dominated by African countries. Kenya and Ethiopia in particular have dominated it at the Olympic level. But there are a couple of Americans that have at least a chance to medal. Looking at the year-end world rankings from last year, in the women's steeplechase, Emma Coburn of the United States was ranked 7th, and she recently just set the American record again at the end of May. Interesting thing about that race, the race in which she set the American record, she only finished 3rd to a couple of African runners in that event. She actually, at the 2012 Olympics, had the 3rd-best qualifying time going into the finals and then I think finished 7th. So she can compete at a high level, but she probably has to run a really good race to medal. There's a man in the U.S. who's ranked even a little bit higher than that. Evan Jaeger is his name. And it's interesting, looking at the year-end world rankings in men's steeplechase, 8 of the top 10 runners are from Kenya.
Hmm.
The other two are from the U.S.
Huh.
The U.S. comes in at number 4 and number 10. Dan Hewling of the U.S. is number 10. But the good news, I guess, if you're one of those guys from the U.S., is that there's only 3 guys from Kenya that are going to be there. You don't have to worry about 8 of them. You just have to worry about 3 of those guys. So there's a chance for
that
the U.S. to medal
here.
That opens
up the field a little
bit
more.
Yeah, it does. So we'll see what happens there. But 3,000-meter steeplechase, it's just one of those races where reading about kind of the way that people compete in it, the key is not to go out too fast.
Mm.
It is an event where if you go out too fast, you not only do you have to worry about getting tired at the end, but you basically end up falling on your face because you don't have the stamina left to go over the hurdles, to jump off that big hurdle over the water pit. In fact, that's what happened at the Olympic trials. The guy who finished third in the Olympic trials made it because somebody fell on the last water jump.
Oh.
Well, that's exciting, though.
Yeah, it is exciting.
I mean, it's exciting for us.
Yeah. That's right. So
I mean, you feel bad for the guy who fell.
It must be fun to watch in person, too.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah. I've never actually seen the steeplechase in person, so I'll have to see if an Illinois track meet next year has that on campus.
I don't know. I might be putting you on the spot, but what's a good time?
Well, let's see here.
Because I'm figuring that's like a mile and... Something.
A good time for women is, or like a really good time, if you're going to win, would be around 9 minutes.
Okay.
Dang.
Right in the 9 minute range. The winning time at that race I was telling you about in Oregon, where they set the American record, the winning time was just under 9 minutes flat, 8:59.97. The American record is 9:10. On the men's side, it's about a minute faster, give or take. The American Jagger, his best time, I think, is around 8:10. I'll have to try and find that.
So,
again.
I mean, that's not even that much. I mean, it's probably a little slower than, but it's not that much slower than actually just running straight up. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, 3,000 meters, I think. Well, basically, it's a little shorter than 2 miles. So, you know, the best times in you know that event are probably around the, you know, in 7:40 mark,
yeah,
I'm guessing.
Yeah. Just real quick before we wrap up with Rio Olympics, is there anything that you guys are looking forward to that isn't like our, you know, your chosen sport? You mentioned gymnastics, John. Is there anything else that you're sort of like, ooh, this will be interesting?
Well, I think the beauty of the Olympics is I don't know until I know, you know.
That's...
I mean, until I see some 3-minute piece strung together by NBC that tears at my heartstrings.
Oh, that's right.
That's
yeah.
when I'll know who to root for.
And then you'll be
for.
A devoted follower because of their story.
Yeah.
I'm not like that. So I'm looking forward to the soccer. So the U.S. women's soccer team, I actually made a mistake in our last podcast. I mentioned that the draw was 16 teams. It's actually 12. So there are three groups. The United States is actually they are favored to win. And Japan is not playing, and Japan is actually like kind of a bit of an arch rival of the United States.
Japan's not in it.
Huh? They didn't qualify.
Wow.
Or whatever you have to do in order to play in the Olympics. But anyway, but they are in a group with France, New Zealand. I can't remember the other team, but it will not be easy for them, let's just say. Oh, Colombia, I think, is the other team. So anyway, I'm looking forward to that. Brian, is there anything else where you're kind of like, yeah, Olympic time again. I get to see this again.
Yeah, I might pay attention a little more attention to some of the cycling this year. Been doing a little more biking myself, so I might try and pay attention to a little bit of the
velodrome. Is that what it's called? Was it something drone?
That's so weird. They all look like
when they're like just going sideways. You know,
and the helmets that they wear look like something from Star Wars.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think it's just called road cycling, John. I don't think it's anything.
You're just doing the road.
Inside.
No, but the inside, the velodrome.
Oh, the inside?
They just go in circles, like you said. You know what I'm talking about. And they wear those cool
If you haven't seen this, you got to watch that because they go up and down. Now, that's a lot of fun.
I should have done that.
Next year. 4 years from now.
2020.
Whenever. Okay. All right. So is it rivalry time?
It's rivalry time.
Okay, so in keeping with the Olympic theme, I chose, it's my turn, so I chose as my rivalry the rivalry between the United States and the USSR during the Cold War in the Olympics. Now, the rivalry kind of existed all the time between the USA and the USSR, not just in sports. It was science. It was, the space race and all that. It was education. It was the arms race. And then it was also in sports. So every 4 years... I think the Russians joined the Olympics, I believe, in 1952. 1952, the Summer Games, and 1956, the Winter Games. And there's always been this huge rivalry. And this year, it's coinciding with this determination by the World Doping Agency that all the athletes and the government officials should be banned from the Games in Rio. This just came down a few days ago, so I'm not exactly sure what's going to happen with that. Now, obviously, the rivalry between the USA and the USSR hasn't existed since the 1988 Olympics, but I think there's still some competition there, you know? And so, and also what I thought was really interesting. So I grew up, you know, in the 70s and 80s, and so that was kind of like the height of this like super competitiveness at the Olympics. And it wasn't just Russia. It was also the Eastern Bloc countries that were sort of ruled over by Russia. There were, I can't speak for the propaganda about the United States from the USSR side, but I know that we were delivered all kinds of propaganda about the evil Soviet Union and all of their minions from these other teams, and all the women took testosterone and like whatever. And there were some doping issues, particularly with the Eastern Bloc countries during the 70s. But I thought it was interesting that during Reagan's presidencies, both the United States and the USSR boycotted the other's Olympics. But in the Summer Olympics, you know, you had the USA didn't go to Moscow in 1980. And the Soviet Union didn't come to L.A. in 1984. I remember being extremely disappointed both times because, you know, you want to see it's like the biggest countries with the best athletes. And it's interesting to see now how the dynamics have changed. Like both the United States and Russia have great athletes, but you see the rise of the Chinese. You've seen dominance appearing in other sports from other countries. So anyway, that's my rivalry. You guys feel free to chime in. I feel like, you know, I loved what happened with the Winter Olympics, but I look forward so much to the Summer Olympics and the gymnastics and the swimming and all of those sports. And so when they boycotted, I was in junior high and high school those years. It was just a huge disappointment. So that's my story. That's my rivalry, man. And we'll post in the show notes, but there's like this great website that gives you like the total medal count, both for summer and winter Olympics between the Soviet Union and the United States. And then there's another site that has their top five. And of course, the hockey moment, I think, is number one. And there was also a really contentious men's basketball game in 1972, but I was like 4 years old, so I don't remember that. But I would have loved to have seen it.
I've seen replays of that game, and I don't know how to explain it other than this, that there are very few times where I can honestly say that referees stole a game.
Oh. Right.
They stole that game in 1972.
At the Olympics.
Do you think, I wonder, and I know it's probably not as big of a deal, but do you think, in Russia, did they think of that like we think of the Miracle on Ice? Like,
probably, because it was the first time that the USA had lost in basketball.
Yeah.
So I think it's similar to that. I am looking at the site you mentioned, Lisa, that shows the medal counts.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of knew that the Soviet Union had really kind of dominated the Winter Olympics. You know, I kind of knew that in my head.
Yes.
And the U.S. was always playing catch-up there.
Yep.
I didn't realize that overall, really, it wasn't even that close between the U.S. and the Soviet Union in the summer games.
That's right.
There's, 2 years where the USA topped the Soviet Union in total medal count in the Summer Olympics. And one of those was the first time that the USSR was there in 1952. The only other time that happened was in 1968. Otherwise, it was all Soviet Union.
So many extra countries.
Right. Well, and then, exactly. Then there's the Eastern Bloc countries where if you add those in, they're not even included.
Romania, Germany, Poland.
One thing that I wanted to mention or ask you guys about, particularly Eastern Bloc countries that weren't Russia, it seemed like, and of course I wasn't alive when this happened, or was I? I was barely not alive. But here's my example. It seemed like we sort of dropped that for certain athletes. I'm thinking like Nadia Comăneci.
Yes.
Like, she was great. Everyone just loved her. She was from Romania. She was from the Eastern Bloc. But it seemed like we suspended our hatred of that because she was just that good.
Well, and she was young.
Yeah.
She still looked like a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of these, we've talked about Nadia Comăneci before, it seems like years ago now. I barely remember a time before you joined us, John, but we talked about her because she was 14 during the 1976 Olympics. All of the other competitors, almost all of them, were at least 4 years older than her across the board. So she looked like a tiny little butterfly girl child flitting around out there and doing these amazing things. And then there were all these like grown-ass women out there were doing the same thing, except not nearly as cutely and prettily. So I think everybody was sort of captivated by that. I know I was. I was in second grade, and I was like, I want to do that. Of course, I grew to be a monstrous 5'10" or and change, so that wasn't in the cards for me. But yeah, so I think even then, like, the media sort of played that up, and she had like this very distinctive piano music that was also the theme music to the soap opera The Young and the Restless, you know, and then she did another thing, like some music box, some dancer thing, something, I don't remember. But anyway, I just remember them playing the clips of her over and over again. But then Olga Korbut, who was injured during those games and did not perform nearly as well, 4 years older, had been the darling of the 1972 Olympics because she had pigtails and she was very young and everything. That once she was grown, it was like she was just part of the evil Soviet Empire. So, but you're right. That's a good observation. I hadn't even thought of that before this. It was like we still wanted to totally beat them in this rivalry. But for some reason in the sports with the women in it, right. It was sort of played up by, well, probably all the dudes. I don't know.
Yeah.
Interesting observation. I'll have to think about that more. Thanks, John.
Sure.
Good rivalry, Lisa.
Thank you. Well, it's, you know, it's appropriate. We can trot it out for every Olympics, really. Okay, you guys take it. I'm mostly an observer here.
We can go through it quickly, but basically, John Gross got here. He's the head coach of the men's basketball team.
At the University of Illinois.
He replaced Bruce Weber, who went out of town in with some custard and not a lot of other good opinions held of him as a coach.
Mm-hmm.
People liked him as a person. John Gross came in his first year. He made the tournament. Everyone was like, I think his nickname was JFG, and you can figure out what the F stands for. Everyone loved him. He was in on some very good recruits, famously the most famous of who was Cliff Alexander from Chicago area, 5-star center, high, you know, top 5 prospect in the entire country. He famously reached for the Illinois basketball or the Illinois baseball cap to say he was choosing Illinois, and then at the last minute went to Kansas. And like,
talk about a social media moment.
Ever since then, like, that's like the moment where John Gross went from superstar to people started asking questions. His recruiting, he's been in on a lot of 5-star recruits. 5-star is obviously the best. And then they always have been choosing other teams. He's famous for being the bridesmaid. Here's my top two: Kansas and Illinois, North Carolina and Illinois. I'm going to North Carolina. I'm going to Kansas. Then the team has underperformed. There's probably a lot of reasons for that. One of which is obviously injuries. They've also had some off the field issues. I think we might have hit on those previously. But last week or the week before? Jeremiah Tillman, a 5-star who's actually originally from Southern Illinois, currently playing at La Lumiere in Indianapolis, which is a powerhouse high school basketball program.
A prep school.
Decided to choose Illinois, and it's sort of the word has changed.
Yeah, it's let's say made the coach's seat a little cooler, at least for the time being.
Yeah.
I think the hope is still that Illinois will have enough on the court this year to get to the NCAA tournament, which is a possibility if they can stay healthy. They've got Malcolm Hill going into his senior year, who should be at or near an All-Big Ten level performer. They've got Tracy Abrams, hopefully, back after missing 2 full seasons with a torn ACL and then a ruptured Achilles tendon. So that's a pretty good foundation. They got a 6th year of eligibility for Mike Thorne, who was a 5th year transfer last year, was off to a really good start before he had a knee injury. It was uncertain whether the NCAA would grant him that year. They did, so he'll be back. That should help the inside. The one big negative for them on the court, which stemmed from an off-the-court incident, was Kendrick Nunn being dismissed from the team. He was expected to be alongside Hill to provide another at or near All-Big Ten caliber player in the backcourt. He's not there, so it'll be up to a younger guy, Jalen Coleman-Lands, to kind of step up and take up some of that production. So on the court this year for Illinois, they should be better than last year if they stay healthy. But the long-term question is still, You know, can Illinois use Tillman's commitment to help bring in some more big name guys and really kind of help get the ball rolling recruiting wise for good here at Illinois, rather than these fits and starts that we've seen over the last 20 years?
So I have a question for you guys about, well, first of all, if I were John Gross and his coaching staff, I think I would never sleep. I would lie awake at night praying that nobody got injured. I would be like a mess waiting for somebody to get hurt. So that's one observation. I mean, just because there's been so much. The second thing that I want, or the thing that I want to ask you guys is, like, what goes into rebuilding a team? It's not just about building that year's team. There's the brand or the vibe around your program. It's like rebuilding a program.
Right.
Is that starting now? Finally, is that? I mean, and what does that mean, and how do you measure success? Because you're saying, like, hopefully we get into the NCAA tournament. As you might be aware, there's a call-in show after games from another station where if we lose to, like, Michigan State, we suck and we're terrible and we can't do this and we can't do that and Gross this and the players that. And it's like, I think that it's fair that rebuilding a program and a team within a year and having the expectation of, like, we want to get to the NCAA tournament, you know, and obviously you want to win every game. I mean, that's, you want to do that. But, like that's not acceptable to the outside. So how much of a factor is external stuff?
Well, carry obviously on. External is pretty huge factor for Illinois.
Yeah, it's big. And I think what you started seeing finally, last year, you really saw attendance fall off for Illinois.
After they unveiled a brand new State Farm Center?
Yeah, yeah. And attendance really fell off because there were lackluster results on the court, and the fans voiced their displeasure by not filling the State Farm Center last year. So that's certainly something that, you know, Josh Whitman will be looking at as athletic director. Is that place getting filled up?
That's
because
true.
We spent a ton of money on that.
Right,
we need a full house.
Right.
And winning will take care of a lot of that. If they start off well at the beginning of this season, then you'll see big crowds for a lot of the Big Ten games, and, you know, we'll see what goes on from there.
I mean, ultimately, you know, we talked about this off the mic because I had said we don't really know how good of a coach John Gross is, and what I really meant is within his system. He's supposedly, his whole offense runs through an active point guard who can shoot outside, to run the ball screen offense, right, Brian?
Mm-hmm.
And he has yet to recruit that. We'll have to see how the latest point guard, Tajon Lucas, can play into that. Now he has a big man. He's had a lot of bad luck, let's be honest, so I don't think it's fair to pin it all on him, but he also hasn't really, to this point, shown the ability to succeed with a different system. So, I don't know, we'll see.
All right, is it social media nonsense? We got to think of a name for this segment. I can't think of anything right now. Not right now, but so
send your suggestions to.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We'll get to the contact us part for sure, and you can send us all your suggestions that you want. Brian, what did you see this week?
Pass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got nothing?
Really?
Well,
there's been a lot of bad news, and it's hard to.
Yeah,
that's true. When you live in the newsroom, it's sort of like you're at the mercy of the newsroom.
I've been all focused on other stuff. So
your regular job.
What?
Unbelievable.
Yeah. No, I apologize.
This is a very quick one. I've always actually been a big fan of Charles Tillman. He played for the Chicago Bears for several years. Cornerback. He's famous for his nickname is Peanut. He's famous for the Peanut Punch, in which he basically, instead of trying to strip the ball out of the receiver's hand, he would just punch it out. It was very successful. It's so fun to watch. So if you want to go online and look up the Peanut Punch, that's very fun. He seems like a really nice guy. I follow him on Twitter. Seems authentically, you know, you say everything with people in the media, all the regular things. I don't know him as a person, but he seems like a very nice guy. Supports a lot of great charities. Seems very keen on the military. Does a lot of nice things for that. Anyway, he played his entire career with the Bears. Then he got injured. They released him. He played last year for the North Carolina Panthers. And Then he got injured at the end of the year, didn't get to go in the playoffs. I was actually rooting for the Panthers in the Super Bowl specifically so that he would get a Super Bowl ring, but that's unfortunate. Anyway, he announced his retirement this week. In fact, I think it was just yesterday, and he did it in a spectacular fashion. We'll definitely put the YouTube video up on our site, but basically it's a video of him, like, at home doing regular things, like hanging out with his kids and, like, punching things out of their... So, like, his daughter's, like, watching TV. He punches the remote out of her hand, you know. So it's a very entertaining video and fun, and it's actually kind of ends in a sort of a nice, touching way. It was pretty cool, so that's mine.
It reminds me of, like, one of those ESPN commercials.
Yeah.
You know, where they sort of magnify whatever
yeah.
the athlete
definitely
is.
Definitely got a yeah. similar so vibe to those. That's funny. It's entertaining.
I can't wait to see it. All right, my social media thing is actually something, you know, I went back to the well of Reddit. Because I heard somewhere that the folks in R Soccer, which is populated mostly by people who are not Americans, deciding that they wanted to take a cue from the RNFL subreddit, which is all about, you guessed it, the National Football League. Every year, the RNFL subreddit roasts each NFL team. So they're like New England Patriots, and then everybody chimes in and roasts the Patriots. So they decided to try that in R Soccer. Lots of problems with that. First of all, somebody wanted to make it just the English Premier League, and everybody else was just like, wait, what about La Liga? What about, so, you know, so there's that problem. But they started with Arsenal, who everybody loves to sort of make fun of Arsenal. I don't know why. I mean, I've watched lots of Arsenal games. But anyway, what I discovered is that a lot of the people there don't really have very good senses of humor when it comes to their team being roasted. But I will post a link in the show notes. So they're going to keep going. I think they're going to do the EPL teams first because the season starts in August, and then they're going to they may move on to others if they have time. There's a lot of British in-jokes in this thread. A lot of things that people are like, oh, good one, mate. And I'm like, what does that even mean? I have no idea what this means. I'm not even sure it will go on because there's been so much. There's 1,500 comments in this thread. But I did enjoy this one. What does an Arsenal fan do when their team has won the Champions League?
I don't know.
Turn off the PlayStation. Ba-dum-bum. Okay, so that was a good one. But I think we need to wrap it up here. So I'm just going to go ahead and wrap it up. Is it time to wrap it up? Let's wrap it up. Okay, thank you from all three of us for hopping onto the bandwagon this time around. Plenty of room for everybody. The podcast is produced by the three of us, John Steinbacher, Brian Moline, and me, Lisa Braltz. Brian records and edits everything. He's the technical director. I'm dealing with the web. John just sits here. Scott Cameron Boom. Is WILL's Director of News and Public Affairs. This podcast was his idea. Sorry, everybody. Jim Kelly designed our logo and suggested the theme song, which is Bandwagon by REM. And tech support has been provided by Mike Bowman and Taylor Judd. You can find past episodes of the podcast on our brand new website. We're at will.illinois.edu/bandwagon. Show notes, videos, etc. We should be in iTunes soon. You can follow us on Twitter and send us your suggestions of any and all kind at Bandwagon Podcast, all consonants, no vowels. That's at Twitter, by the way. And there you can Twitter stalk each of us on your own if you want. The next episode of this podcast will come your way in about 3 weeks instead of two because these two jokers are going on vacation.
Not together.
Not together.
I mean, that would be wonderful, but
no.
Oh, too bad. So we're already looking forward to the next episode, but in the meantime, thank you again for listening. Over and out.